Hi, everybody. This is Carmen LaSalle. Welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio and to a speech given by Bay Area author and syndicated columnist Norman Solomon on Wednesday, July 27th, 2005, at the Woman's Building in San Francisco. This event was a benefit for two nonprofit organizations, Global Exchange and Media Alliance. Global Exchange is a membership-based international human rights organization dedicated to promoting social, economic, and environmental justice around the world. Media Alliance is dedicated to excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media in the interest of peace, justice, and social responsibility. The communications director of Global Exchange, Andrea Buffa, began the evening by introducing Norman Solomon.
My name's Andrea Buffa. I work at Global Exchange, and I'm just going to introduce you and welcome you to this event on behalf of the two great organizations that are co-sponsoring it, Global Exchange, which is an international human rights group based here in San Francisco, and Media Alliance, as far as we know, the longest-lived media activist group in the United States, also based here in San Francisco. So without further ado, I want to introduce Norman Solomon. I can't tell you how highly I speak of him. I've known him for many years. He's a Bay Area person, and he's constantly out here with us talking about media coverage of every issue from housing to the war in Iraq to police brutality to whatever it is that we care about and we're concerned is not getting adequate or accurate coverage in our news media. He is a syndicated columnist, a nationally recognized media critic, the author of numerous books, and the most recent book that he's going to be talking about, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. So let's welcome Norman Solomon.
Many times in the last few years, I've remembered something that I heard at the First World Social Forum in Brazil back in early 2001. The great writer Eduardo Galeano talked about walking down the street in a Latin American city, and there, written in big letters on a wall, were the words, "Let's save pessimism for better times." That approach seems more relevant than ever as in 2005 we confront a status quo that seems to be moving overall in some very perilous directions. In the last few months, I've also remembered quite often the experience I had of going to Salinas, California in early April. And I walked down the street in one of the poorer areas of that city of 150,000 in central California. And there in the trailer parks and rundown homes on that afternoon were the children of people who pick crops in this country and put food on the table, make profits for the big companies, and earn so little. And the neighborhood that they lived in, as I walked through, would have been considered poor in many third world countries. And here we were in California in 2005. And I walked on through to the Cesar Chavez Library. And there underway was a 24-hour read-in by writers who were joining with others in the community and from around the state and beyond to protest the planned closure of every one of the three public libraries in the city of Salinas. Why? Because, according to the local government, there was not enough money to keep those public libraries open. And through the night, people camped out, and a couple of days later, there was a New York Times story, which, as things go, was a pretty decent article about the protests in front of the library. But one of the things that was not mentioned in the article was a key theme of the protest in front of the Cesar Chavez Library, and that is that money for bombs was greatly overshadowing money for books. And as I walked around the library that night, one of the aspects of the protest that was not reported was that projected on the wall was a kind of a ongoing spinning odometer that showed the amount of dollars that were being spent from tax money provided by residents of Salinas, California for the war in Iraq. At that point in early April of 2005, it was about $84 million. And of course, it's a lot more now. And as I looked out at the tent city there as part of the protest, I thought back to the first time I ever saw a tent encampment where people had pitched those tents to demand social justice. The year was 1968. The place was the Mall of the National Capitol in Washington, D.C. And the occasion was what was called the culmination of the Poor People's Campaign, an enactment of an effort to demand and achieve social justice. And that encampment was known as Resurrection City. Martin Luther King had been killed before the Poor People's Campaign reached Washington, D.C. that spring. And here we are in 2005, and we are in wartime, as those protesters were in 1968. And as the summer got underway in that year, the federal government sent in the bulldozers, literally and figuratively crushing the Poor People's Campaign. And as I looked at the tent city outside the Cesar Chavez Library in 2005, I thought about the words of Martin Luther King when he denounced what he called the madness of militarism. The militarism that was tearing apart Southeast Asia and in its own way tearing apart the United States of America in 1968. And the militarism that is with us today. That madness of militarism is, as King put it, and transposing his comment about how the bombs in Vietnam explode at home, now the bombs in Iraq are exploding at home as well. Because it's not just the public libraries that are being damaged and sometimes crushed by this military spending, by the fact that we now live in a 24/7, 365 warfare state. It's also educational institutions, the schools, the colleges, the preschools, the childcare, the health clinics, the emergency rooms, the community centers, all sorts of basic services that have something to do with sustaining life instead of destroying it. And with very little media scrutiny, the madness of militarism that Dr. King spoke about in 68 is on a roll as we see the continuation of what has been called so often a war on terror. And like many people in recent years, I've been trying to understand how we got to this situation where more than a third of a century after the Poor People's Campaign, so much is being devoted to destruction and so little to sustenance of life. And we're now looking at, from here to the horizon, a continuation of a situation where the Bush administration continues, with help from the mass media, to make good on a pledge that was made by so-called Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld 2 weeks after 9/11. In an op-ed article in the New York Times, he said that this war would be like no other, that there would, with an unintended, I think, allusion to what takes place in George Orwell's novel 1984, there would, Rumsfeld said, be shifting alliances, and the United States sometimes would be aligned with some countries and then with others. But he said there would be no exit dates. There would be no deadlines with this war. In effect, he was saying in the early fall of 2001 what we know to be true now, several years later. This is a perpetual war. This is a military-industrial media complex bent on perpetuating itself, the massive profits of contracting, the massive spoils to be won, although we're not supposed to talk about that, 112 billion barrels of oil known to be under the ground in Iraq. How many people think that there would be 140,000 U.S. troops in Iraq today if there was not a drop of oil under the sand? And yet, when those issues are raised pointedly, so many in the news media, entrenched in their newsroom bunkers, say, "What nonsense. We know that the United States government is run by people who may be at times mistaken or inept, but certainly have nothing but the best of intentions." And I think of something that Michael Hare wrote in his book Dispatches, reflecting on his work covering the Vietnam War as a correspondent, and I quote it in my book, War Made Easy. He said that the Pentagon in Vietnam was able to do just about everything in terms of destruction, everything in terms of technical capability, sparing virtually no expense. As he put it, the U.S. military could do everything but stop. And here we are, where the warfare state is incapable, it seems, of stopping, and yet the imperative is that it stop. And as has always been true in history, it will be up to people at the grassroots to insist that the madness of militarism that Dr. King described be ended. When I look back at the last 40 years, I wasn't really searching for parallels between the media coverage of the Vietnam War and the media coverage we get today of Iraq and the so-called war on terrorism. But as I did the research, as I looked at the articles and the transcripts and the contemporaneous coverage of what was going on in Vietnam, it was repeatedly hitting me between the eyes how much similarity there is in our current situation. You know, people say, and I've heard this in debates, you know, Iraq is not Vietnam. And I think any competent geographer would certainly agree. And different continent, different language, different history, and the different history of U.S. intervention. But the reality is, when it comes to the rationales, when it comes to the psychological mechanisms that are manipulated through the media, we have enormous similarities, boilerplate arguments that are made, and behind the overt surface, we have dynamics as well as to motivation. And this is the corporate love that dares not speak its name too overtly in public in the corporate mass media. But I went and I ordered a whole lot of annual reports from military contractors. And by the way, I think it's so important that we call things by their correct names. You know, the military budget of the U.S. government, not including the special supplemental appropriations that are the sleight of hand bookkeeping for PR purposes, but the basic military budget of the United States is more than $1 billion a day and rising. And yet we have a situation where there is denial in the news media about what you can see by reading these annual reports of these military contractors. I think that it would be justified to have a defense budget, but we don't have a defense budget, we have a military budget. And that distinction in terminology is constantly blurred to the benefit, of course, of the war makers. But when I looked through those annual reports, I found, because it's a legal requirement, I found it stated quite clearly, small, medium, large military contractors stating to their stockholders very clearly that as long as the United States continues with its, quote unquote, war on terror. As long as there is U.S. military engagement in Afghanistan and Iraq, the profits will keep rolling in for the company. But the danger of a precipitous drop in profits and income for the companies involved, stated very clearly, the danger would be that those wars would end. And that would be, as the stockholders were warned, that would be a huge problem in terms of the well-being of the company. Well, if you look back, I tried to do the research starting with the early 1960s. You find so many similarities with what we have been experiencing and still are experiencing in the first years of the 21st century in terms of agenda building. And when I looked for these kind of boilerplate processes to drag this country into war, you've got to have agenda building. Every president who has been able and willing to get this country into war has engaged in that process, setting out the agenda, laying out the media drumbeat time after time, the essence of propaganda being repetition to hit the same themes over and over and over again. And we saw that in 2002 and into 2003 before the invasion of Iraq. All the talk about weapons of mass destruction, all of the wink, wink, nod, nod, semi-implications that there were connections between Saddam Hussein and 9/11 and the Saddam Hussein regime and Al-Qaeda, falsities put forward as truisms, deploying the squads of the punditocracy and the corporate-funded think tanks and the ex-administration officials. And then we had the dynamic week after week and month after month, what we now know were the planted stories, the lies put out through the New York Times on the front page, often under the byline of Judith Miller. What were the sources, the unnamed sources? Ahmed Chalabi, the pet Iraqi exile, pet of the Pentagon of Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld. So you had this agenda-setting dynamic where Pentagon's funded and nurtured exiles would serve as unnamed sources for, in this case, the New York Times. Those deceptions would be put on the front page of the New York Times. And then you'd have people like Wolfowitz and Powell and Rumsfeld go on the Sunday TV chat shows and say, look at what the New York Times just reported. They're verifying what we've been saying. There are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There are ties with terrorism in Iraq. We can't stand by and wait for the smoking gun to turn into the mushroom cloud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we're in an agenda-setting phase again. And it has to do with a number of countries, perhaps, but certainly inclusive of Iran. And, you know, I've heard people say that it's speculative that the United States might be involved in a military attack on Iran, and nobody knows for sure. I don't know if it's going to happen. I do remember that 3 and 4 years ago, we were told in no uncertain terms that it was highly speculative when people suggested that the Bush administration might be preparing for an attack on Iraq. In June of this year, I was able to go to Iran. I spent 10 days in Tehran in the lead up to and through the first round of the presidential elections. And I thought quite often of something that Dr. King said about the arrogance of the West feeling that it has everything to teach and nothing to learn. And that's certainly reflected in the US media coverage of Iran, and it helps to build the agenda for some kind of military attack. Could we learn something from Iran? Well, a lot of things we wouldn't want to learn. We have our own trouble with fundamentalist extremists in charge of a national government. But while it may be a stretch of the imagination, there are certain aspects of their very, very flawed and in some ways very undemocratic election process for president that the United States could learn from. For one thing, they have their elections on Friday, which, of course, in a Muslim country is a holiday. how long, for how many decades, have progressives been urging that we have our elections on a holiday rather than a work day, so working people especially can take time off and actually go and cast their ballots? What a concept, right? We also had a situation in Iran that does not exist with the presidential elections here. The winner needs to get more than 50% of the popular vote. And in fact, for the first time there since the introduction of the Islamic Republic, nobody did get 50% and there was a runoff. What would have happened in 2000, A, if there was a popular vote, and or B, if there had been a requirement for a runoff if there had not been a 50% plus one vote for any candidate? But it's true there's a lot of undemocratic and repressive aspects in Iran. I do know that a few days before the election in mid-June, I sat in a stadium in Tehran with about 10,000 Iranians who were there in support of Mustafa Moin, a reform candidate for president. There was widespread campaigning in the streets. We came out of a mosque, and there were flyers stuck under our windshield. Very much a vigorous debate. And I know this is a low standard, but the distance in political position between Mr. Moin and Mr. Ahmadinejad, who eventually was elected president, the distance between their political outlook was significantly wider than the difference between the political outlooks of George W. Bush and John Kerry. Now, I know that is a low standard, but the U.S. news media, echoing the White House, told us that it was a meaningless election. Of course, after the most odious candidate actually won, the most hardline candidate, Ahmadinejad, won in the runoff, all of a sudden the White House, echoed by the U.S. news media, said that it was a profoundly important event that pointed to the depravity of the regime in Tehran. But we are in the midst of agenda building towards perhaps some kind of attack on Iran. I know that people say, well, the U.S. military is tied down, the troops are tied down in Iraq, they can't possibly be involved in an invasion. Well, for one thing, it doesn't take many troops to launch missiles. It doesn't take many troops to launch and sustain an air war. Let's remember in 1999, the U.S. led NATO bombardment of Yugoslavia went on for 78 straight days, bombing urban areas like Belgrade continuously, and to the pride of the Pentagon and the Clinton administration, not a single U.S. serviceman or woman died during those military operations, counted as a political and military success. Do we really believe that the Bush administration is incapable of launching such a horrendous air war on Iran? And what is the character of the agenda building? Well, a lot of it is about nuclear development in Iran. And yes, there's a nuclear power program. The salesmanship that has been underway out of this country for 50 years, beginning with the Eisenhower administration, the so-called Atoms for Peace program. You know, it's very interesting. For decades, the anti-nuclear movement in this country, discounted by the U.S. news media, was saying that you can't separate nuclear power and nuclear weapons development. And finally, when it's time now for the administration and the news media to point the finger at Iran, all of a sudden the light bulb went on. And yes, their nuclear power program might contribute to development of nuclear weapons. Well, the best realistic assessment is that Iran is keeping its options open. Unlike Israel, it submits to international inspection. Unlike Israel, it has zero nuclear weapons right now and is years from such acquisition. Unlike Israel, it is a signer of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But how many articles and broadcasts in the U.S. news media do you hear talking about the threat to the region and beyond posed by the more than 200 nuclear bombs known to be in the arsenal of the Israeli government? Well, this is part of the agenda setting, the condemnation of Iran. In a region not only with Israel having nuclear weapons, but Pakistan, an enemy of Iran, having nuclear weapons, and beyond that, India, and on and on. And then the links to terrorism, and here we get into the continual double standard that is stoked by the White House and politicians in Washington and fired up continually by the U.S. news media. Terrorism is what we say it is, when we say it is, when the victims of horrendous crimes against humanity are ones that we are told we should care about. You remember perhaps the day, that horrendous day of a crime against humanity, 9/11, Colin Powell, Secretary of State, was in Latin America. And he immediately issued a statement condemning those who would destroy buildings and kill people for political purposes. This someone who, in his role in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spearheaded the planning for an implementation of the attack on Panama in 1989 that killed hundreds and hundreds of people, many in their beds, to overthrow Manuel Noriega, who, like Saddam Hussein, was a U.S. ally for quite a while. This from somebody, Colin Powell, who was instrumental in the leadership of the Gulf War. This from Colin Powell and others of that sort of leadership in Washington, who are willing to condemn, as we all should, the crimes by Al-Qaeda, and yet are willing to be silent about or even implement other crimes, other places that involve the slaughter of innocents for political purposes out of Washington. What are we talking about? We're talking about the history of the last 40 years in terms of U.S. military actions, one after another after another. But the hypocrisy is central to agenda building. And so whether it's about nuclear weapons, whether it's about terrorism, those are hot button issues that have been installed and are being pushed by the Bush administration now, turning up, turning down the heat. But the agenda is underway for a possible attack on Iran. And in looking at history, I went back and researched and wrote about in this book the invasion of the Dominican Republic. And in a review of the book in the Los Angeles Times, the reviewer, who actually was very complimentary about the book, described the invasion of the Dominican Republic, which I start the book about, as an obscure event. And in a way, that's evocation of the problem. When people in the Dominican Republic, 3,000 of them lost their lives and their loved ones were left behind, those were not obscure events. We read in recent months that many of the names of Iraqi civilian victims of U.S. military actions in Iraq, their names are unknown, by which the news media mean that their names are unknown to the U.S. news media. They're certainly not unknown to their loved ones. Part of the propaganda system for perpetuating war is to convert into virtual non-people those who are at the other end of the U.S. missiles. You know, I have nothing against embedding reporters if they're embedded on both sides of the arsenal. We had 700 U.S. reporters embedded during the invasion of Iraq, and of course it was, in retrospect, a brilliant propaganda move by the Pentagon, got them the kind of empathetic coverage for the invaders that they had dreamed of. If we'd had a similar number of U.S. reporters who were embedded with those who not only sent the bombs but received them, not only fired the bullets but were there when they arrived, perhaps the tenor of coverage would have been less in the cheerleading mode for the invasion of Iraq. In the case of the Dominican Republic, to some, perhaps an obscure invasion in April of 1965, Lyndon Johnson, in the bipartisan tradition that has been upheld since then, lied to the public to justify doing what he wanted to do, which is to send in U.S. troops to kill and be killed, especially to kill. And we now have access to the transcripts of recorded telephone conversations that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the White House. He loved to use the telephone. It's a great way now to track what was actually going on. And I quote some of those transcripts in the book. Just a moment of background. After decades of the very brutal Trujillo dictatorship in the Dominican Republic, He was finally out of the way. He died. And there were free elections in the Dominican Republic. Almost two-thirds of the voters chose Juan Bosch, who took office, and months later, after he became president in 1961, was overthrown by a military coup. Years later, there was a popular uprising to restore the constitutionally elected President Juan Bosch. And in the Dominican Republic, in Santo Domingo, that uprising was on the verge of success, restoring Bosch to power. And then the White House ordered a U.S. invasion to prevent that calamity of restoration of democracy from taking place. And here on the morning of April 26, 1965, the pro-Bosch revolt was gaining ground in Santo Domingo. President Johnson in the White House spoke with an assistant secretary of state named Thomas Mann, and this is from the transcript of the tape recording. Of course, Johnson knew it was being taped, and the assistant secretary of state, Thomas Mann, did not. The president said, "We're going to have to really set up that government down there and run it and stabilize it some way or another. This Bosch is no good." And the reply from the yes man at the State Department, "He's no good at all. If we don't get a decent government in there, Mr. President, we get another Bosch. It's just going to be another sinkhole." Then the president says, "Well, that's what you ought to do. That's your problem. You better figure it out." And Assistant Secretary of State Mann says, "The man to get back in, I think, is Balaguer. He's the one that ran way ahead in the polls." And then the president replies, "Well, try to do it, try to do it." Well, who is Balaguer? He was somebody who was in the Trujillo regime. He was in exile in New York at the time of this invasion. He was advising the White House on how to proceed. And he was the person, in fact, who the U.S. installed once the Marines and other U.S. troops took command. So that's how it went. What were the excuses? Well, Lyndon Johnson went on television. He said, "We've got to go in to protect American citizens." By the time the Marines arrived, almost all the American citizens were off the island, out of the country, out of any possible harm's way. He said later on, 2 days later, back on television, "Well, we think maybe communists are involved," as I document in the book. That was a lie. Then for good measure, he got back on TV another 2 days later and said, "We know there were communists alive," and that was just a more adamant lie. And we know that from history. It's commonly understood now in coverage, retrospective, what little there is of the invasion of the Dominican Republic, this non-event in terms of U.S. media and history. But the problem is, as Napoleon said, it's not necessary to censor the news. It's sufficient to delay it until it no longer matters. Philip Graham of the Washington Post, a few decades back, he liked to say that journalism is the first draft of history. The problem is it's usually the last draft, and a lousy draft at that. Well, agenda setting is really part of the process. It's the way I begin the book. And then I go through 17 different boilerplate themes, which have come up time and again. They're propaganda techniques, models, lines that are put out and beat on mercilessly to convince the public that this war is either a good idea or not such a bad idea that it should be vehemently opposed. And I thought I would read them off to you just as kind of a collage and then go back and walk through them in terms of some examples. So here are those 17. America is a fair and noble superpower. Our leaders will do everything they can to avoid war. Our leaders would never tell us outright lies. This guy is a modern-day Hitler. This is about human rights. This is not at all about oil or corporate profits. They are the aggressors, not us. If this war is wrong, Congress will stop it. If this war is wrong, the media will tell us. Media coverage brings war into our living rooms. This is a necessary battle in the war on terrorism. What the U.S. government needs most is better PR. The Pentagon fights wars as humanely as possible. Our soldiers are heroes, theirs are inhuman. America needs the resolve to kick the Vietnam syndrome. And this last one in the book, we're right in the middle of with both feet. Withdrawal would cripple U.S. credibility. Well, these are the media propagated myths. They're deadly myths, and in a circular fashion, we as a society are trapped within them. If you look at the first one, often the most powerful myths are implicit. Everybody knows this is true. You don't even have to explicitly state it. It's just something we can assume, we can count on. America's a fair and noble superpower. And so if you look at the last issue of Time magazine in 1999, the back page had a forward-looking essay by the eminent member of the punditocracy, Charles Krauthammer. And the headline was, "A Second American Century?" with a question mark, and Krauthammer's piece provided some answers. This is what he wrote. He said, "The world at the turn of the 21st century is not multipolar, but unipolar. America bestrides the world like a colossus." And then he goes on to say that this is a good thing. He said there was not a serious challenge to U.S. domination because, quote, "it is so benign," unquote. And if you start with that assumption, the nobility and benign nature of U.S. power, then of course, what's not to like? It becomes a technical question of how it's possible for the U.S. to work its benign will in the world. Then, of course, we hear the leaders will do everything they can to avoid war. And I've gone through the last 40 years of U.S. war history, and you would think by the law of averages that there would be at least one war that wasn't fundamentally based on deception. You would think there would be at least one war in the last 40 years when the President of the United States sincerely sought, as he claimed publicly, to find a peaceful alternative to sending in the troops and sending the missiles and slaughtering people. I couldn't find a single one, from Vietnam to the present war. All of them based on deceptions, all of them based on flagrant lies. Let's talk about Vietnam for an instant here. We can walk through each year of the Johnson administration's escalation of the war in Vietnam. 1964, this is what President Johnson said. "Our one desire, our one determination is that the people of Southeast Asia be left in peace to work out their own destinies in their own way." 1965, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, "Our commitment to strengthening the peace has not weakened." 1966, President Johnson, "I do not genuinely believe that there's any single person anywhere in the world that wants peace as much as I do." 1967, Vice President Humphrey, "There is no quick and easy way to peace. It must and will be built out of the cumulative acts of men and women who dedicate their lives to the service of their fellow men and therefore to the service of God," unquote. And then in 1968, President Lyndon Johnson, "But our goal is peace and peace at the earliest possible moment." Well, another boilerplate, our leaders would never tell us outright lies. Anybody who's paying attention knows that that is a lie. I don't need to belabor the statements about weapons of mass destruction, but those are not atypical. As my book documents, you go back from the Vietnam War and go through to the present day, every single war fundamentally lies being told, from the Gulf of Tonkin onward, presidents basically trying to scam the country into war. And here's a sobering reality. You can't find in the last few decades or earlier any instance where the President of the United States wanted to drag the country into war and was unable to do so. The Constitution says it is up to the Congress to declare war. And yet the president has become more and more absolutely capable, without meaningful substantive opposition, to work his will and bring the resources of the United States into this destructive activity that we too flippantly refer to as war. I talk in the book about a time when I was at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a hearing in early 1968, and I'm going to quote from it a little bit later. Senator Wayne Morrison, extraordinary senator, said, as he put it, "I do not intend to have the blood of this war on my hands." And here in 2005, where is the single U.S. senator willing to say that about this war in Iraq? We have a long way to go. We have news media that refuse to give voice to the demands from the grassroots, although the polls reflect it. So many people are furious about the destruction of this country's resources to pay for this war. What are we talking about? $200 billion already, this war in Iraq, while our own communities are suffering from lack of basic funding. Our leaders would never tell us outright lies. What kind of fantasies are we supposed to believe? Then there is the theme, this guy's a modern-day Hitler. And that was true of Saddam Hussein, we were told. There's an anecdote I tell in the book, The New Republic, the kind of liberal, neoconish sort of amalgam magazine. In 1987, they had an article urging more support out of Washington for the regime of Saddam Hussein. Of course, Saddam Hussein had ordered the invasion of Iran in 1980, and the war was still going on, and just a very horrible, bloody war. The U.S. was siding with Saddam Hussein's regime. When I went to a meeting with Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, a couple of months before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we brought along to him a copy of Time magazine. There was Rumsfeld on the cover. He said, Rumsfeld's turned into quite a warmonger. He didn't seem that way when he came and visited us in 1983. Quite palsy-walsy from the Reagan administration to Saddam Hussein. And the New Republic is part of the eminent punditocracy, saying in 1987, we need to provide more support for Saddam Hussein. In 1990, when the winds had shifted and the not-so-bad guy was suddenly a Hitlerian, really bad guy, the New Republic actually digitally doctored his mustache to make it look more like a Hitler mustache for the cover. So there you got truth in advocatory journalism. But Slobodan Milosevic as well. When the Clinton administration decided it was time to solve the Kosovo crisis by creating huge numbers of refugees and bombing urban areas such as Belgrade and elsewhere in Yugoslavia, what was the line? Well, it shifted. Slobodan Milosevic was like Hitler. This was the war that many liberals love to love. This was supposed to be a good war. And I talk in the book, this bears on many of the myths, I talk about how the fundamental lead into the war was based on lies. You had this myth that Slobodan Milosevic was intransigent when in fact he had been handed an ultimatum at the Rambouillet talks in France before the war began. Appendix B of that ultimatum said that he should accept that US-led NATO troops would have the run of the country, do essentially anything they want throughout Yugoslavia, not just throughout Kosovo. And it's really quite striking, and it's like these other statements I'm making, totally footnoted in War Made Easy. I talk about how the US news media knew about this and simply thought it wasn't newsworthy till the war was over, and even then barely reported. The American people, according to the military-industrial media complex in how it functioned, had no right to know that they were being dragged into a war based on a lie, based on an ultimatum that no sovereign government would accept, based on an ultimatum that the U.S. public didn't even know about. And it was extremely unreasonable. It was predicated on the assumption it was time to go to war and let's just get on with it. Well, then there's the myth this is about human rights. And you would think that if it's important for the U.S., important enough to go to war against countries that engage in torture, then it would be a good idea to stop paying for torture. The U.S. government now, as we speak, each year spending a couple of $1 billion on aid, for instance, to Egypt, a country that tortures its political prisoners. And yet we're supposed to believe that the U.S. goes to war in support of human rights. The hypocrisy is breathtaking. And just go back to history again about if Saddam Hussein, when he was doing his worst crimes in the 1980s, was worthy of an alliance with the United States, how does that square with the claim that it was necessary to go to war against him later because of his despicable record on human rights? It's a very key technique for war propaganda. It's embraced by mainstream journalists almost entirely, not entirely, but the exceptional story or commentary is not what's so important. It's the repeated themes. This notion, the Orwellian notion really, that some history is very important and some history is totally unimportant. So if you're to say to someone who's advocating for the Bush administration activities, the deadly warfare being engaged in by the Pentagon in the Middle East right now, especially in Iraq. If you were to say, well, look at the history. The United States government was aligned with Saddam Hussein while he did these horrendous crimes during really his worst stretch of human rights cruelties and murders and tortures. And you're told, oh, come on, that's ancient history. And yet, when it's useful as part of the war propaganda, how often have we heard Saddam Hussein gassed his own people? He gassed the Kurds. The same time period, the 1980s, one bit of history, fundamentally important, the other, forget about it, not worth mentioning. Well, that's very Orwellian. The notion that they're the aggressors, not us, that's part of the same package. In War Made Easy, I document time after time whether it was the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964 or the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, the United States bent on provoking and attacking before the formal war took place, although not with a formal U.S. congressional declaration of war. The Gulf of Tonkin incident took place, or didn't take place more precisely for the most part, led to the closest thing we ever had to a declaration of war. And yet, the public did not know that the United States itself had been running attack operations off the coast of North Vietnam against that country before the Gulf of Tonkin incident. I document this in the book. I got to wondering, a few years ago when there was the tailwind story that CNN broadcast about the alleged use of gases on Laos by the U.S. government, deadly gases. And after the documentary aired on CNN, there was a big uproar and some mucky mucks complained and demanded a retraction. You know, the paragons of truth like Henry Kissinger went to CNN and said, you've got to retract that. And CNN folded like an accordion and said, oh yeah, we'll retract it, which they did that. And so I thought, well, okay, let's find out whether our quote-unquote great newspapers ever retracted their mendacious reporting on the Gulf of Tonkin incident. You can go back in the microfilm. It's not on the electronic databases for the most part, but you go back to the microfiche. You see the front pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post, the LA Times. They all reported absolute lies as absolute truths. And as War Made Easy points out, that is not really different fundamentally than what we've been getting in recent years. But in this case, it was the simple technique, and this is often true, of attributing. But not only attributing, saying that the Pentagon officials or the president said X, often they didn't even bother with that. They just said that North Vietnamese had attacked unprovoked in the Gulf of Tonkin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I got to wondering a few years back, well, did the New York Times or the Washington Post ever retract their front page lies that, I mean, you might say there were some consequences to their front page lies, like 2 million Vietnamese people killed, 57,000 American soldiers died in Vietnam, and then some later after they got home. So was there a retraction? Well, I called the New York Times, couldn't get a straight answer. Called the Washington Post. Finally, somebody said, well, you want to talk to Murray Marder. Mr. Marder, as I could see from the microfilm, had done the main front page Washington Post reporting about the Gulf of Tonkin at the time. So I found him at home, talked to him on the phone for quite a bit, and he said, Mr. Solomon, I can assure you that the Washington Post never retracted anything about our coverage of the Gulf of Tonkin. And I said, why not? And he replied, well, if news media were going to retract their reporting of events in the Gulf of Tonkin, they would need to retract virtually their entire coverage of the whole Vietnam War. And I suppose implicit in that comment was, we certainly couldn't have that. Then, and this is certainly related to the Gulf of Tonkin events, my book talks about this myth, if the war is wrong, Congress will stop it. And we've seen how efficacious that is. Part of this is the scam that we've seen, this ritual. The Congress is consulted, the president gets an up or down vote on some kind of resolution, and then you have all kinds of people in Congress later on, if the war doesn't go well, saying, well, gee, I just wanted to give the president a bargaining chip. I wasn't really voting for a war. Well, of course, they really were voting for as close to any kind of war resolution as we're going to get. And this dynamic has gone on again and again. There's the parallel myth, if this war is wrong, the media will tell us. I've already mentioned about the New York Times, but it's really across the board with very few exceptions. When the war drums really start beating and there's quote-unquote intelligence in the air, it takes a journalist with real fortitude and a media outlet willing to back him or her up to say, now hold on, let's look deeper, let's not take for granted and take at their word what these officials are saying. And one of the important antidotes to this dynamic is for the public and journalists to grasp what the great independent reporter I.F. Stone said several decades ago. He said, all governments are run by liars and nothing they say should be believed. Now, Stone wasn't conflating all governments, and he wasn't saying every government lies all the time. Of course he wasn't. What he was saying is that to take on faith any statement by any government official is to court disaster. We're asking for trouble, and we often get it when we simply trust that we're being told the truth. You know, history tells us quite often through one technique or another, we're getting something quite opposite than the truth. There's also a very powerful myth. Media coverage, TV coverage brings war into our living rooms. It's a very comforting myth. You know, what did you go through during the war? Well, I sat in my living room and watched television. This delusion that somehow watching TV or reading Time or Newsweek brings the war right to us is part of the propaganda mechanism. President Bush said about a year ago, and I quote him in the book, it's really awful. Nobody likes to watch the war on TV. Can you think of anything less like being in a war zone than watching television at home? I mean, it's a total conceit, and yet it is perpetrated, is encouraged so that we're encouraged to feel that we somehow are engaged with what war is really about. War is really about fear, it's really about death, it's really about killing. And television is so far removed from that, it's simply part of the numbing process with very, very few exceptions. One parallel myth is the idea that if only, and people on the left, anti-war movement people, sometimes embrace this. I think it's not really very accurate. Often we believe that if only the public were shown the gruesomeness of war, that there would be an uprising to stop that war. And I quote Susan Sontag in her book Regarding the Pain of Others. She really takes apart that mythology. And she points out that the images of war have a context. They're created by words, they're created by a mindset, a political and media atmosphere through which we are perceiving those images. And the face of a valiant or suffering US soldier or of a victim of the soldier's activities, those images can give rise to any number of responses. It could be that the war is wrong and should be stopped. It could be, look what these people are sacrificing for freedom. We must not allow them to die in vain. That's a common response. And I think it underscores the importance of dealing with facts, dealing with information, and challenging the kind of psychic numbing that is central to war propaganda. Yes, there are key analytical threads that need to be put forward to expose the lies behind the war agenda. Yes, there is factual information that must be exposed, but we also are challenged to deal with the numbing process. The consequences of the deception, for instance, coming out of the White House in the lead up to and during this war on and in Iraq, the consequences are usually put in a fog of journalistic euphemism. It's a numbing process of journalism to detach us from the realities of what is being perpetrated on human beings in our names with our tax dollars. And this whole thing about war being brought into our living room is part of that process. We're all familiar with the line that opposing a war means siding with the enemy. And that was true during the Vietnam War. It's true today that we get that kind of excuse for the rationale that people should not use their First Amendment rights. They should pipe down. They should follow their commander in chief. I was on a national talk show the other day, and somebody called up and said, you know, I'm really sick and tired of people criticizing this war. Just as the Vietnam War ended too soon, people deserted Vietnam. They cut and run from Vietnam. And I said, well, conservative estimate, the U.S. war in Vietnam caused 2 million Vietnamese deaths. How many more Vietnamese deaths did you want? And the reply was, as many as it takes. That's what Martin Luther King, in part, was referring to when he talked about the madness of militarism. It's not so often fleshed out into the open, but it is there. It is a might makes right philosophy. As Senator Morse said, in the mid-1960s, the United States had become the greatest threat to peace in the world. Martin Luther King said in 1967, the United States government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And in 2005, that is clearly the case. And yet, the more clear it is to most people in the world, the more it must be denied here in the United States. And is there any mechanism more useful in that denial than the so-called war on terrorism? 9/11 was a godsend for an administration that already had, in the planning stage, an invasion of Iraq. A political blank check that has been cashed with hundreds of billions of additional military dollars in spending, a blank check cashed in other people's blood. This is the policy elite, the neocons in Washington, all these smart guys who knew that it would be a cakewalk to Baghdad. And I went through the articles written by, for instance, Kenneth Edelman, you know, one of those great neocon smart guys. And he had a piece in the Washington Post before the invasion. It's going to be a cakewalk. And then when the statue of Saddam fell, he had another piece 13 months later bragging about how he had written the first piece, predicting accurately it was going to be a cakewalk. And you know, I'm waiting to see Kenneth Edelman cakewalking through Baghdad today. I don't think so. But it's a process of a bait and switch to lure people in to think that the war is going to be fine and dandy. And later on, well, once we're there, we can't cut and run. Lyndon Johnson said we can't cut and run. George W. Bush says we can't cut and run, and many others as well. When we talk about the war on terrorism, the war on terror, it's an absurdity. I quote William Odom, the retired U.S. Army general, saying it's preposterous. You're never going to win a war on terrorism. It's like saying you're going to win a war on night attacks. Terrorism is a technique. It's used by the not so powerful, don't have Pentagon-sized weapons by any means behind them. And we are engaged in a cycle of violence. We're encouraged by media and our so-called political leaders to believe in this great American exceptionalism, this notion that, you know, there are cycles of violence out there in the world, but we stand apart from that. When our loved ones are killed, as in 9/11, everything changed everywhere for all times. But when people elsewhere are killed, especially when U.S. taxpayers footed the bill for the killing and the Pentagon did it, well, you know, it's not so earth-shaking, to put it mildly, according to the framework of U.S. news media. Here we are in a situation that George Orwell well described in his famous essay, Politics in the English Language. He said, in our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible, unquote. And so as the U.S. government kills civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq, no more guilty of any wrongdoing than those who were slaughtered on 9/11, it is called a war on terror, even while it terrorizes and kills. And how is it that news media so seamlessly, so often, simply go along with this process? I go to a quote, not so well-known quote, from George Orwell. He said, "Circus dogs jump when the trainer cracks his whip, but the really well-trained dog is the one that turns his somersault when there is no whip." And if you go through the newsrooms of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and we are told the great media outlets in the United States, there are no whips in evidence, not at all. Simply imitating other journalists, doing what is within the parameters, understood to be within the parameters of journalism. But whether it's about war or anything else, real journalism is not stenography for the powerful. It is assertive, it is independent, it has a multiplicity of sources, it goes for the truth sooner rather than later, and it comprehends in human terms what is at stake. I'm going to close in a couple of minutes, and then I know we're going to have questions. But before I end, I'd like to read from a song that was written almost 40 years ago by Joe McDonald, and I'm very glad to have been able to include it in my book, War Made Easy. Red and swollen tears tumble from her eyes, while cold silver birds who came to cruise the skies send death down to bend and twist her tiny hands, and then proceed to target B in keeping with their plans. Cocky priests of Christendom, interpreters of love, ride a stone leviathan across a sea of blood and pound their feet into the sand of shores they've never seen. Delegates from the Western land to join the death machine, and we send cards and letters. The oxen lie beside the mud, their bodies baked in mud, and fat flies chew out their eyes, then bathe themselves in blood, and superheroes fill the skies, tally sheets in hand. Yes, keeping score in times of war takes a superman. The junk crawls past hidden death, its cargo shakes inside, and soldier children hold their breath and kill them as they hide. And those who took so long to learn the subtle ways of death lie and bleed in paddy mud with questions on their breath. And we send prayers and praises.
You have been listening to Norman Solomon speaking at a benefit for Global Exchange and Media Alliance. Norman has just published the book, War Made Easy, and he has established a website where you can read excerpts from the book, www.warmadeeasy.com, all one word. The next part of the evening's program was a question and answer. Audience members filled out cards, and Andrea Buffa of Global Exchange and Jeff Perlstein, Executive Director of Media Alliance, read the questions to Norman and he answered them. You can download the question and answer session as part two of this evening. The Global Exchange website is www.globalexchange.org. The Media Alliance website is www.media-alliance.org. San Francisco Liberation Radio is a 24/7 internet radio station found at www.liberationradio.net. Music in this show is by Aleph Newell, whose website is music.gavinjoyce.com. Thank you for listening. This is Carmen LaSalle.